learn more, volunteer, or make a donation.
You are listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM, coming to you from the top of Burnaby Mountain in Burnaby, British Columbia. We are pleased to be here providing great community programming for you throughout the year, and we hope you enjoy it too. Next up is our regular gardening segment with Pablo Vimas, and we bring you this every week as part of our regular Monday programming, and today we're going to be talking about composting. So here's Pablo. And it's time now for Gardening with Embark. Joining me in the studio is Pablo Vimas from Embark Sustainability Society. How are you doing today, Pablo?
Doing very well, thank you. And glad to be here.
Good. So we're going to talk a bit about composting today.
Oh, yes. So composting is the heart of the gardening. Mm-hmm. Whatever we don't use or don't consume or any plants leftovers, all of them end up in the compost. But yeah. Here in campus, we have to have some things in consideration. One of them is rodents. Mm-hmm. So when we established our gardens, we were made aware that we don't want the garden to attract rodents, neither to attract wildlife. Mm-hmm. So then we have to find a container, a composter bin that helps us to prevent the access of rodents. So it will be rodent proof.
Right. So let's jump back just for a second to the sort of basics of setting up the compost and what you're going to be putting in there.
Oh yeah. So we will be putting any plant material that is healthy. So mm-hmm. being part of a plant, produce when rotting in the plant itself, yeah. And leaves that are yellow, but any plant that is still is healthy, weeds that don't have seeds, mm-hmm. plants that have bolted but still have no seeds. So everything mm-hmm. goes in the composter, and all that plant material is chopped into mm-hmm. small pieces, 3 to 4 inches long. We chop, 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 and that goes in the compost. The fact that we chop is in order to accelerate the process of decomposition.
Right.
Composting is nothing else than an accelerated decomposition process. Mm-hmm. Nature does it normally. They compost any material that lays on the ground. But we in the composter, we manage, and so therefore that's why is that the composition process faster.
Great. Now at Embark, of course, you're up on the campus.
Correct.
And so you're primarily using the sort of leftovers, so to speak, from the garden.
Yes.
For home composters, they're often putting in kitchen scraps as well. Is there anything they should be particularly avoiding?
Oh yeah, for home composting, we will put kitchen scraps, but we avoid any meats, and any dairy, and fats, and any dressings that we put in the salads or salads with dressing. The fact is that the composter will be the habitat for earthworms, mainly the red wigglers. And red wigglers, they don't like vinegar. They really don't like they run away of it. And the other is lemon peels as well. They don't like lemons and orange and onions. Onions, onion peels, lemon peels, orange peels, and vinegar. And right. Of course, the earworms are not going to digest that. That's why we avoid doing that, and bones, certainly we don't add any meats in the composter. So that has to go in the food scraps bin.
Right. So it's important to understand that this is different than what you might be doing with just your food scraps bin, you know, where, you know, for instance, in my case, you know, I'm putting it in a bin and then it's taken away and I'm not putting it in a composter.
Yep.
But for the home gardener or any For the compost, you need to be much more careful and selective about what goes in there.
Correct. Yes. So as well, if you start putting meat, you are attracting rodents. So that's the other thing that we don't want to attract rodents. For instance, even avoiding full fruits, sweet fruits like apples and bananas tend to attract rodents. So we just try to avoid putting those products in the composter.
Now, up on the campus, as you were saying, you're particularly tasked by the university itself, where the gardens and the compost are happening, to make sure you're taking steps to avoid problems with rodents. So tell me a bit more about that, because I'm sure this applies to home gardeners as well.
Oh yes, so rodents are the main problem that, and particularly over winter when they are looking for a space where to nest and over winter. So in campus we were very clear, giving clear directions that composters shouldn't attract rodents and other wildlife. So we did a bit of research. There are composters that are very easy to purchase either for the here in Burnaby. We have the ecological center, recycling center, where we can buy composter for $40. But those are no rodent proof. So after a bit of research, we came up with a composter that was developed in Australia called Aerobean, Aerobean, and that composter is a square. Has a ventilation pipe in the middle, and all the liquids that generated during the decomposition process can be collected. So as well, no leaching around the composter. So again, no attracting any flies or preventing bad odors. So those were the things that the composter that we decided to use here in campus.
So
Go
where do
ahead.
you have the composter set up? Is it on is go ahead.
So the composter is set up on a pallet, a plastic pallet, that is to prevent that. So the composter is a bit higher than the ground, and as well, here is snow, so we don't want the composter to be in contact with the snow during the winter time. And other particular is that most of the times we add some salt, road salt, to melt the snow, and so we don't want that either to be around the composter. So yes, so that we have a bit above the ground.
Now, you've talked a bit about what goes in there, but from my understanding, it makes a difference to the relative mix of things because the whole situation or the composition of the composter needs to serve that composition or decomposition process and make sure that that's happening. So how do you balance out what goes in to make sure you're getting a good process happening in there?
Correct. So we have to. So we have in when we do composting, we have two materials: the green ones, which will be all the plant material, and the brown ones, which is dead leaves, cardboard, newspaper, the containers from that come the eggs, chicken eggs that comes in those containers. We can rip those and add to our composter so that we have browns and greens. Usually is one brown. One green to two, oh, sorry, two greens and one brown. So two volumes of greens and one of browns in order to keep the composter moist. We don't want a composter that is all soggy and because it starts smelling as well. It smells when it's all to just greens. The greens bring lots of water, and that becomes quite slimy, and it creates bad odors because the bacteria are dominating in there. So we want something that keeps the balance, so it still is moist but not too dry. And we want moist and And that creates a habitat for the earthworms as well to are in a nice environment, because we don't want the area to be too dry. Yeah.
Is there ever a need to mix or turn the compost?
With the composter that we are using, no. Because they are already have a ventilation pipe in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so, but if you are using a three-tier composter, yes, you will need to turn it, the composter, to turn the material. So the top material goes to the bottom, and therefore it accelerates the decomposition process.
Right, so you're doing a good job with your composter, and things are going along well.
If it doesn't smell, and it's nice to pour your head over the composter, and you are not disgusted with what you are seeing. So that's a good sign that, yes, you are composting dried. But right. If you open your composter and you have this waft of smells, and you see inside all gooey, you know that something is wrong, and you need to add more brown material.
Right. So it should sort of smell kind of good and earthy. Is that it?
That's it. Yeah, it has to smell very good and earthy. Yeah.
Okay. And how do you know when it's ready to use? Because, of course, part of the point of all this is to create fertilizer that you can put back out in the garden.
So we are putting back in the garden. Then after 6 months, because the composition process is very slow,
mm-hmm.
And we collect the composted material from the bottom, bottom of the composter. So slowly we sieve the material. Yep. Through a mesh before adding to the garden beds.
Right.
Yep.
And what does it look like at that point?
At that point, looks very crumbly.
Yeah.
And it smells good, and kind of a nice soil, earthy soil.
Great. And of course, this is all part of emphasizing the cycle of life in the garden. You know, plants. Grow and are harvested and die, and then we return as much material as we can back into the soil, because of course that's how we make rich, healthy soil.
Correct. Yeah, and we keep the fertility of the soil full of nutrients for the plants for the next season. So yes, the composter, as at the beginning I said, is the heart of the garden.
Yeah. So what would you say, just sort of, if you could sum it up in one line, what's the most important thing for the gardener to think about when they're working with their compost and composting?
Have chop your plant material, chop, and add dead leaves. In my case, I like to collect dead leaves. During the fall, I collect lots of leaves, and those are used to add to the composter. If there is no leaves, use lots of newspapers or cardboard. Earthworms love cardboard. And yes, keep the ratio. Sometimes, as I say, it could be 1 to 2, but with experience, we just add accordingly how much material we have. It's a practice. How you add your materials, but please chop it. If you just plant the full plant, it will take ages to decompose.
Right. And then you mentioned the importance of keeping seeds out.
Oh, yeah. That is one of the big problems that here we have in campus, because we have more than two gardeners gardening in our learning gardens, and everybody just wants to get rid of plant material that they are removing from their plot. So that is the issue, that we have weeds in there, plants with weeds, tomatoes that got rotten, goes into the composter, and then when we are harvesting, all those seeds are coming back, and then you put this nice composter in your soil, and suddenly you have tons of weeds, tomatoes coming back.
Random plants growing everywhere.
Yes, random plants. And then you are like, I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't. So in community gardens and here in campus, that is the main issue. Try to keep the weeds with seeds and fruits with seeds out of the composter.
Okay. Well, great. That's some great advice for gardeners on working on their composting and returning all that goodness back into the soil. Thanks so much today, Pablo.
Oh, thank you for giving me the opportunity to share this with our listeners.
Excellent. How do people find out about Embark, more about Embark?
So Embark Sustainability is a nonprofit organization that is based in SFU campus in Burnaby. And you can find us in our website at embarksustainability.org or in our social media channels, hashtag EmbarkSustain.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability Society. We'll talk to you again next week.
See you next week. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
This is Bird Note. If you are new to birding, you might assume that you need fancy binoculars or have to venture off to some exotic places to look for birds. Truth is, you don't even have to leave your home to enjoy birds. In fact, many folks do it right from home. That's usually how we first experience birds, by watching and learning the birds out the window every day. And you don't actually have to physically go anywhere to find birds. You can use a smartphone or computer to go birding. There are several websites where you can view live feeds of nests, like the Cornell Lab's feed of a red-tailed hawk nest in Ithaca, New York, or the Hellgate Osprey nest at the University of Montana. You can even have your own bird feeder camera, thanks to at-home setups like BirdFi and BirdBuddy that allow people to watch the birds in their backyard. You can learn a lot about birds by observing their feeding habits and how they interact with other species. And then the next time someone complains that you're on your phone too much, you'll be able to tell them, "Hey, I'm enjoying nature." For Bird Note, I'm Jonice Franklin. This episode is brought to you in loving memory of former BirdNote board member Tom Darden, with thanks to his family for their support.
Welcome back. We're going to talk about, Peter's going to talk about, the 1941 Abbott and Costello film.
Buck Privates was their first starring vehicle. And I talked about National Lampoon's Animal House 2 weeks ago, and Stephen was taken aback by my criticism of it. Yeah. But also, I'm going to put it in perspective what I said 2 weeks ago. I'm going to bring up some of the problematic aspects to this film, which is an older film. It's another type of humor of another era. And one could even say that National Lampoon's Animal House is sort of a very contemporary film. In fact, that's our contemporary humor still. I don't think it's kind of changed from that. So in the 20th century in film comedy, you got the silent era.
Yep.
And then actually it even goes into the 1930s because Chaplin does two silent features that have his he composes his own music for it on the soundtrack. Harold Lloyd does five films in the 1930s, so it kind of goes into the 1930s. A lot of the silent comedy. It's the 1940s when it's a major change. It's more of the radio type of comedy. In fact, Abbott and Costello, even though being very visual, they're still audio. They became known through radio first. Yeah. Now, if I don't know, Magnus, have you seen the 1987 film Full Metal Jacket?
Yes, I have.
Okay, if you were to see Buck Privates and the first third of Full Metal Jacket, you would be shocked in how similar those two segments are.
Yeah.
And the problem that I find is that, of course, in Buck Privates, it's all funny.
Yeah.
In fact, when I did see Full Metal Jacket in an audience, some people find it amusing. Of course, it's not. I hope you don't find it that amusing, Full Metal Jacket.
No, it's a very dark film.
In fact, the first third is the darkest in many ways. I don't know, maybe you feel the second tooth?
Well, it's been quite a long time since I've seen the film, so I can't break it down by parts. But I do know what you're getting at, because, of course, the whole point of basic training, military training, is to break down the soldier and make them part of the team. And so there's a certain amount of, I don't know what you want, a psychological efforts at you know, breaking down a soldier, you know, which is what the film's about.
Well, I mean, and as I said, do you ever see a similarity in, I don't know if you've seen Buck Privates previously in that and Full Metal Jacket, the first third of it. Did you ever think it was sort of like the same thing in a way?
I don't think I had seen Buck Private prior to seeing Full Metal Jacket, so no.
Okay, so
that association. But it's interesting to think about, because, you know, I mean, we've seen, you know, basic training segments in many films, right? It's many ways a sort of common part of many war movies, right?
Right. As such, I haven't seen a lot of them. But I, so I guess that's my criticism. I mean, knowing that.
Yeah.
You're sort of aware of how I'm critical of this film.
Okay.
And it's sort of... Okay, go on.
Well, let's play this clip here we have. This is a clip from the film. And it the most part of this clip actually features the Andrews sisters, who are another act that were debuted to the broader public in this film.
Yes. And it's also big band. The big band era is 1935.
Yeah.
Interesting enough, it supposedly stops 1947 for the actual bands themselves. Supposedly the speed limits slowed them down. I know there's something I saw the Ken Burns thing on jazz, and they said that the speeds limit couldn't make the acts. I don't know, but actually in movies, big band really lasted until rock and roll.
Yeah. So just very quickly before it plays, just sort of set it up a bit. What's happening?
This is a film I'm kind of critical of. They get Lou Costello, one of the worst boxers of all time, to be in the ring. And it starts off that they got a real puny guy, and they said, "Oh, you don't have anything to worry about." And then they go to the Andrews Sisters song. The other thing is they give something that culturally is good that you don't have anymore. It's called, and I never got one. It's called the Mahot Foot, and you put a match under the guy's shoe and you light the thing, and he's on fire. Supposedly he can survive it, but I wouldn't want to. So we have a bit of a setup with they're going to get Lou to fight in the boxing match, and then we go from there.
Yep.
Come on, I got some trunks that'll fit you perfectly.
I don't want to fight that guy. I ain't even mad at him.
You mean to say you're scared of that little guy over there?
I mean to tell you that I'm... Is that the guy I'm going to fight?
Yeah.
Oh, tell that fellow to stay in the ring. He's a pushover.
Sure.
Well, I can picture myself now. The place is crowded. I'm coming down the aisle, I jump in the ring, I throw off my robe, and the whole crowd lets out a terrific roar.
And what happened?
I forgot to put on my pants.
Come on.
Okay, boys, okay. Relax. Entertain yourselves till Private Brown gets into his fighting togs.
A famous trumpet man from out Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was the top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blowing reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. They made him blow a bugle for his Uncle Sam. It really brought him down because he couldn't jam. The captain seemed to understand. Because the next day the cat went out and drafted a band. And now the company jumps when he plays reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. A toot, a toot, a toot-a-lead, a toot. He blows it eight to the bar. In boogie rhythm, you can't blow a note unless a bass and guitar is playing with him. He makes
makes the company jump when he plays reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. He was the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. And when he played boogie woogie bugle, he was dizzy as a bzzz bee. And when he plays, he makes the company jump way to the bar. He's a boogie boogie bugle boy of Company B. Toot 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 la da toot la da toot toot. He blows it into the bar. He can't blow a note if the bass and guitar isn't with him. The company jumps when he plays reveille. He's the boogie boogie bugle boy of Company B. He puts the boys to sleep with boogie every night and wakes them up the same way in the early bright. They clap their hands and stamp their feet because they know how he plays when someone gives him a beat. He really breaks it up when he plays reveille. He's the boogie boogie bugle boy of Company B.
Company B. And that was the Andrews Sisters from the 1941 Abbott and Costello film
Buck Privates.
Yeah. And the scene ends there. The Andrews sisters finish up and go off screen, and Lou Costello comes back out in his shorts and his... And
well, what they do is that they change. The other team decides that guy's too puny to block, so being a real big guy in. And in the Lux Radio Theater one, he loses it. He gets a black eye, but in the film variation, he... what happens, he picks up like that, but the stool, and the guy hits his head. That's why he wins the fight. All but right. It's actually kind of one of the worst parts of the film, because it just makes a humor of being plummeted. And one person made note is that the sergeant has money for Lou Costello to win. Like, he has bet money from the win, and let he's sabotaging it because he enjoys him being plummeted.
Right.
And so it's how perverse the sergeant is to make sure that Lou's life is not very good.
Right.
In general.
Even though he's bet money.
He's
going to lose his bet.
Yeah. But he winds up winning in the movie,
So we got a couple of minutes left. So what is your core criticism of this movie?
The core criticism is that it makes it right to make him the butt of all the horrible things. I mean, it's done as being a humor.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like a National Lampoon Animal House. The guy's car is ruined, totally ruined. I think it was a cousin or something, and it's funny. And John Belushi puts beer cans on his forehead to lighten them up. Yep. So it's sort of, it's kind of even worse in a way, I guess. As I said, if you see the first third of Full Metal Jacket, you see kind of how that could lead in many ways. So Stephen wasn't here. Maybe he likes this one too. I don't know. Likes this movie. Also, a historical note about the film: this was brought up early 1941, before Pearl Harbor. There was a peacetime draft in the United States starting September 16th, 1940.
Yeah.
And then, in fact, they say the youth of America are now peacetime buck privates.
Right.
That's what they say in it. So it's sort of a historical movie because it's in that sort of strange area. They haven't yet entered the war.
But yeah, it is sort of interesting because it's before the United States enters the war. They're still at peace.
But
it's very much a kind of wartime movie in a sense, in that, you know, it's like later films that happen. It's, you know, boosting the army and the experience of being in the army and the patriotism and nationalism of service.
Yes, it boosts patriotism.
Yeah.
But there was a draft. There was a military draft during the film,
which stayed all the way to the 1970s.
Yes, that's correct. There was a break in 1947, 1948.
Okay. Well, that's our time for today. You've been listening to Speak Up here on CGSF 90.1 FM. My name is Magnus.
It's Peter R.H. is here.
Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up right now.